Hello, everyone. This is a podcast for the Centre for Public Integrity, Australia's leading think tank on making our mighty nation accountable and a functioning democracy. We're up against some formidable authoritarian forces, so it's all shoulders to the democracy wheel. We're very fortunate today to have with us the Honourable Margaret White, AO. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, Quentin.
Margaret, you have a truly impressive CV in academia and the law. You're a former Supreme Court judge and Royal Commissioner. You've been involved in landmark constitutional cases as a barrister. You're a commander in the Royal Australian Navy and former Deputy Chancellor of the University of Queensland. Now you're an advocate for the anti-corruption cause as a director for the Centre for Public Integrity. I'm trying to establish why and how you're motivated to do this work at this stage of your life and career. You have three adult children, and that's a very rich life and professional experience. Please tell us how it all started, where, and family, and growing up.
Well, although I was born in Hamilton in Victoria, and I always like to mention that when I'm in Victoria, because that gives one a lot of standing, it was a wartime accident, and I was educated and grew up in South Australia. And I know that on the eastern seaboard, you like to mock South Australia. But in fact, it was a very rich background in which to grow up, because it gave the first suffrage for women. The local papers of the time, when the women came out to vote, and it was universal, it wasn't just unmarried women, as you remember in other places. And the nuns came out of their convents. That was particularly mentioned to vote, that it was like a great festival day. I think it was also the nonconformist religion, although I was a Catholic and I went 12 years to a Dominican convent. Nonetheless, the foundations of the state were by nonconformist Protestants, those who wouldn't sign the 39 Articles. In the UK, they knew that because of that prejudice, they would never get on. And so they were really interested to come to South Australia. So it was pretty interesting. And of course, I was at university during the time of the rise of Don Dunstan. And it was a group of businessmen who founded the first Adelaide Festival of Arts. So that they, and they founded the University of Adelaide by their own subscriptions and so on. So it was a good background, I think. One felt very comfortable there. I did start medicine.
Was there any lawyers in the family?
None at all. Both my parents were school teachers. And politics was meat and drink in our family of the socialist kind.
Right. You mentioned medicine.
Oh, I thought I was going to do medicine because I matriculated for medicine. But I realised I'd reached the apogee of my mathematical capacity, and it really wasn't going to be a successful university career. So after a couple of weeks, I changed to law. I wasn't very interested in law, but my father said, "Well, give it a go." I didn't regret that I'd done it.
Law is a hard slog, isn't it?
Compared to medicine, a breeze. Absolutely a breeze. Yeah.
But why I say that is because all my lawyer friends say they agonised over the detail that they had to be across.
That's true. But look, what about all those chemical formulae that you had to learn? Goodness, I found science quite difficult because of that memory stuff, whereas there's a lot of seat-of-the-pants stuff in the law.
And so you graduated, and then you went into academia. You started to teach law.
Well, there was a bit of an interregnum, Quentin, and that, of course, was probably a fundamental formative period in my life. I became research assistant to Professor D.P. O'Connell in the University of Adelaide, along with a couple of other people. He had a Ford Foundation grant from the United States to investigate the effect of independence on treaty commitments by colonial countries that had been largely in the British Empire, but also in the others. This may sound a little arcane and strange, but you think about it. If you're not a member of the Universal Postal Union, which is not a UN body, you can't post a letter internationally. There's no way of doing it. Visa abolition agreements, really important for tourism. The United Kingdom extended its visa abolition agreements, which were bilateral, to all of its colonies pretty well. So people who lived in, I'll give an example because I have some practical understanding of it, in Barbados, for example, in the Caribbean, could go to France, go back to Barbados, no visas needed. The day of independence, that was all over. And some of them were stranded at Orly Airport and so on. So the reality of public international law and its whole network of treaties became terrifically interesting to me. And that really was the core of my legal training and work from then on. So I went to the West Indies where I worked and on this project. And it was such an eye-opener for a young person. I was about 22, because I was suddenly exposed to this much bigger world. The Prime Minister of Barbados, when I went to see him, and it's a very small country, 11 miles by 14, he had been a Battle of Britain pilot in the Air Force. He was a Barbadian, as they call them. They had got their independence the year before. And he'd done many, so he just left Barbados and went and signed up in the Air Force. Anyway, he said to me, using a very raffish kind of voice, but he was black as night, he said, "Oh, I say, have you still got that rightfully silly chappy as Attorney General in Australia?" And I couldn't really think to whom he was referring for a while, and then I thought, "Do you mean Mr. Snedden?" "That's him, that's him." And you know, I was then attacked about the mechanisation in the sugar industry, because Barbados relied then largely, he'd just become Prime Minister. But Australia was really taking the market away from them and so on. So I was really thrown in the deep end in challenging ways that I'd never experienced before. I loved those people. There was a joint project with Guyana, which was a much tougher environment, because I don't expect anyone to remember, but Chetty Jagan was the communist chief minister of Guyana, which is just sort of on the top of South America. It used to be British Guiana. And it was thought that it shouldn't be a good idea for the Queen to give independence to a country that was led by a communist. So there was a sort of a coup, which I was told was MI6 at work. And Forbes Burnham became Prime Minister. He also was a lawyer. Now, I could rabbit on forever about what an eye-opener it was to me to see this wider world. These were smart. A lot of those people in the West Indies were three generations University of London graduates. There was hardly an Australian that could boast of two.
Higher educational standards, and then what did you do after your overseas experience?
Well, then I came back and continued with this sort of international law project for the International Law Association. I had in the meantime taken a commission in the Royal Australian Navy, because they realised that our and that was tri-service then. It wasn't all one service. They'd realised that Australia wasn't promulgating the Red Cross conventions to its servicemen, which it was required to do. That's the 1949 conventions. And so they thought perhaps they'd better give some lectures to the final year cadets at the Naval College. So I was given a commission, because Australia had just done Subic Bay, and Chief of the Navy said to me, "We don't want to pay you that much money because the lawyers are so expensive." So I became a second officer RAND on $6 and some cents a day pay. And I used to go every January and lecture to the final year cadets on the United Nations and generally the principles of the laws of war and international law generally. That was pretty boring for most of the lads because they were just keen to get to sea and to leave the college. They found it a little odd, but of course now it's, I think it's very important. And one or two of those students did go on to higher education in international law. They thought it was worthwhile. So then
did
I
get to
married and came to Queensland.
And you didn't get to sea and then on to the University of Queensland.
Yes. When I got married, my husband, who had been a submariner in the Navy, had decided he wanted an education. And so he was leaving the Navy to go to university to study law. So one of us had to earn a living. So I applied to the university and got a position there as senior tutor.
And what's up? You just law, you just taught law.
I did. Yes. The only other rather funny one was teaching law to engineering students. That was a bit amusing, very simplistic. Yes, I taught introduction to law to the first years, and I loved that to bits. I loved having the first year students. There are a lot of cynical members of staff, and I was pleased to have them with me first because I wasn't a bit cynical. And then I taught international law for a short, can't really remember now, a couple of years with John Kidd. I taught in the torts course and tutored in it, and I taught legal history with Chris Gilbert. So it was across the board.
And then you moved, you seem to not be cynical from your earlier life experience and your overseas experiences. How is that so? Is that part of your childhood, your upbringing, your family upbringing? Because many people in the law do become cynical and clearly cynical about the way systems operate.
That's true, but those people that I mixed with in the Caribbean and the terrific Canadians, because the Caribbean is a sphere of influence for Canada, and I just worshipped them because they gave me so much help. I went up to Toronto and saw how they managed the treaty systems, which I was able, they were generous to bring back. They gave lots of educational scholarships. So there was so much goodness. And a lot of these politicians that I was working with, they were the ones that had brought their countries to independence against a pretty unattractive former colonial power. The UK had set them out onto their journey as independent countries without much assistance at all. And another one of the research assistants was in Zambia, and I visited there. And again, they were in the high points. A lot of these countries deteriorated, of course, in time with nepotism and corruption. But then it was so full of hope. It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And you could see if you want those institutions to work and everyone's working towards that end, it is good. So I stayed with that.
And then after the University of Queensland, you became a practicing barrister and you're involved with some landmark constitutional cases. Just tell us briefly about that, Margaret.
Well, look, it's about luck and careers for me. I don't know other people, it's brilliance and hard slog, but I was just lucky because Professor O'Connell was by then at Oxford. He was advising Joe Peterson on all those really weird constitutional adventures that he was interested in, like way to Queensland and so on. So Professor O'Connell mentioned me to the Minister for Justice as a possibility if they were ever looking for anybody. And then my next door neighbour at our beach house happened to be a senior Crown solicitor, and he saw me as a good Catholic mother. He was saddled. So I'd just gone to the private bar. And I got a call to say, oh, Margaret, how would you like to go down to the High Court for us with David Jackson? And there's this case about a dam in Tasmania. Queensland was intervening, Joe intervened in every case where there was any challenge to conserve principles, as you well know, Quentin.
I do.
So at that stage, I had not even signed the High Court role of barrister, so I had to scramble and do that. You'll remember that that was a case where the Tasmanian government, which was a conservative government by this stage, wanted to have a hydroelectric dam damming the Gordon River, which was going to flood the whole of the Franklin River and all that southeast Queensland old forests, and it was opposed by constitutional groups. There was in the Commonwealth, it was a Labor government, and they were opposing this as well. And the Hydroelectric Commission was really an organ of the government, but it was sort of independent sufficiently. Anyway, it was an exciting case being as an intervener because I intervened on the side of the people with black hats, not white hats, because that was for Queensland then. Didn't matter. There were more people sitting at that bar table, 22, than since the bank nationalisation case in 1948. It was It was good to be there. And I'll tell you this thing, that there were only two women out of those 22 barristers, Mary Gaudron as Solicitor General for New South Wales and myself as junior counsel for Queensland. And David Jackson was so thrilled. He said, they're so rude about Queensland, but how many women are the others sending? So that was a very important case, as you well know. And it was really whether the Commonwealth could validly prohibit the building of the dam under its World Heritage legislation, which it had brought in when the UNESCO listing of that area of Tasmania was listed on as a place of natural heritage to be preserved. So the Act gave effect to the convention that we remember. So that the issues for the case really were the ambit of the external affairs power, whether in fact it was so expansive as to be able to really manage things that went on what usually thought to be states' areas. And as you know, Quentin, there is forever that tension between Commonwealth and state rights and limits of power, sort of power. The corporation's power was also introduced because of the Hydroelectric Authority that we had power over trading corporations. As you know, that's now been used by the Commonwealth to do all sorts of things. And I think the third point was acquisition on just terms, and that didn't go anywhere. And there was a glimmering of the nationhood power, an inherent power for the Commonwealth to be able to legislate about things that related to Australia as a country. That sort of didn't go anywhere in that case. But the interpretation of the external affairs power, I think, probably was thinking along those lines anyway, because it was really a notion of the external affairs power which allows Australia to take its place in the world community. So it was pretty exciting. Loved being there because we had no responsibility. We were interveners.
Yes. Tell us then about the Mabo case.
Well, the Mabo case was a case that had already been going for a little bit before I came into it, but the junior counsel had taken silk, and so they wanted a new junior. So I was brought into that one. And as you know, it began when the Jelki Peterson government were offering to all the former Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, missions, deeds of grant in trust, doggets, they were called, you might remember that expression. That really was a sort of community title, and that they'd have elections. Now, all the other Torres Strait Islanders and many of the mainland communities signed up to that. They thought that was a good deal. But Murray Island, Mur, better known nowadays as Mur, held out and refused to do that. People, Eddie Mabo was living and working in Townsville. The story's well known. He had Victorian public interest lawyers who were looking for a clause on this topic of the ownership of the land, and they found it in Eddy. So when it sort of started rolling along again, I was in it. But it shows the chance also of some big litigation. For example, the High Court was never going to decide the facts of that case, so they had to send it off to another court. So the first issue was whether it would be in the federal court or the state Supreme Court of Queensland. And Sir Harry Gibb, sitting as he was Chief Justice, sat as a single judge. We argued that because it was about land in Queensland and everything else was pretty equal between the federal court and the state Supreme Court, and the only reason why the feds would come into it was that the plaintiffs had joined the Commonwealth over the issue of land rights. That was all. Sea rights, I beg your pardon. So he concluded that Queensland was the right jurisdiction, Supreme Court of Queensland. But I might say there was a little hint in the plaintiff's submissions that maybe the Supreme Court might be a little inclined to lean in favour of the state government, which is a very awkward submission to be making to Sir Harry Gibbs, I think. Anyway, off it went to the Supreme Court of Queensland. Then when it settled down, we had to get some trial dates. And I think you'll find this astonishing, but it was thought that it might take 6 weeks. That was the longest trial that they'd had. This is in 1985. And so I went for the senior puny judge. And again, this is Chauncey. There were 3 judges available with a block of 6 weeks. There was Peter Connolly. There was Paul De Jersey. And there was Martin Moynihan. Plaintiffs objected to Paul De Jersey because he did so much Crown work before he took an appointment to the court, which is a pretty outrageous thing, but frankly, to submit. But there it was. So there was a bit of going on by the allocating judge, and finally he settled on Martin Moynihan. It was a great choice because he was passionately interested in the topic. He loved the witnesses. He was so enthusiastic. And I think that made the hearing go so much better. Anyway, there it was. And of course, it's regarded, I think, as one of the great cases constitutionally. It was such an honour to be in it because everyone fell by the wayside. David Jackson went off to the federal court. They finally, the Crown looked at me and said, well, look, even though you're not silk, you know so much about it, will you be the lead counsel? And so I did that one for the hearing of the facts. And it was the most important thing I've ever done.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And and it's helped to change our understanding of dispossession.
It has. It was, I think what's... I would have liked to have been on the side of the plaintiffs in that case, quite frankly, Quentin. And I really yearned for it to be Pat Keane who was arguing because Ron Caston, of course, everyone praises the late Ron Caston. He did wonderful work. His style wasn't my style. He was a bit more emotional about it all. He opened for 3 days. It's a long time. I'd sort of like to get on with it and perhaps pare it down a bit more. But of course, they won the day anyway in the end. But I think there was more nuance in it. You know, it was popular in Queensland to be terribly critical of Pat Killoran, whose name would be well known to you. You probably knew him.
Yes.
Up in the Torres Strait, he was the protector up there. And he certainly wasn't seen as a racist by any means. So I think he had lots of friends and family. You couldn't help but love those people. They were so interesting and fun. They reminded me of the West Indies people. Mm. But in any event, they left the Torres Strait Islands alone, really, to get on with their lives because they didn't have anything that the Queensland government or its businessmen wanted. There was a little effort by a fellow called Lyons to set up a fish factory one of the three islands of the Murray Island group, but that didn't take off. He lived in Lennon's Hotel, I remember that.
Tell me, yeah. Margaret, just jumping ahead to the 2023 Voice campaign, what was your reaction when you saw the Australian public go from 60% support for constitutional recognition, which again would constitutionally have validated Mabo in the High Court, to see that go from 60% support to 60% negative?
Well, I was deeply disappointed, of course, because I felt that it was all based on false understanding of what was entailed in it. And I found that pretty challenging, that so determined were those people, not all of them, I suppose, not all of them, but so determined were many of them, that it shouldn't happen for political reasons that were not actually deeply held reasons. And it was based on false premises about what the Voice actually meant. I think probably that was a shocking experience for me. I couldn't believe it.
Many people are still recovering from that.
But it is interesting that there were many Aboriginals who thought that it wouldn't get up, because they actually had a sense things would go wrong. But yes, they are.
Yes. Back to you, Margaret. On the you accepted a judicial appointment, and that lasted for some years. Was that something you welcomed in your professional life? Because the life of a judge is pretty lonely, I'm told.
Well, I would have liked to have finished off Mabo. I took the appointment after Martin Moynihan had reserved his decision, which we'd come to the end of the trial over many years and vicissitudes, as you know. And I, of course, it was going for the law up to the High Court, because it was only the trial of the facts, and I would like to have stayed the course on that. But it was a family decision. My husband said, one of us has got to have a pension. How cautious is that? I had been offered the district court, and I'd said no, because of family life, I couldn't go away into the provinces and leave the children. My husband was a barrister as well. So he said, oh, well, arrangements could be made so you didn't have to do circuit work. I was outraged. I said, certainly not. I either go in as an equal or I don't go in at all. Anyway, I was offered to Masters, and the Masters stayed in Brisbane, so I had that rug cut from under my feet. 2 years as the Master, then Don Horton committed suicide, which was a catalyst, I think, for the Labor government to decide there'd be no more Masters. And so I was appointed to the Trial Division in 1992. So I had 2 years as a Master of the Court. It wasn't a bit lonely in any real sense, because I was in court with dozens of barristers and solicitors every day. I'm naturally a bit of a busybody and curious. And so I found that jurisdiction really terrific. And my judicial colleagues, stunned as they were to have a nobody come in on the court with them, but were very pleasant. So that was fine. So I loved being a judge, Quentin. I really enjoyed it.
And writing judgments is a work of literature as well as logic. Were you skilled? You're proud of your work in the writing of your judgments?
For a while, for many of the judgments, I was a bit slow. I found the rollover of the work a little constant. Some I thought were okay. Mostly I realised that the litigants wanted a decision. They really didn't want literary works of art. I hope I improved as the years rolled past and got better at it. But I really called on Shakespeare or Milton to assist me in my reasoning process.
What about Latin?
Well, I did Latin as a student, and I still find that it can say in two or three words what we take many others to say. An example, in the Succession Act, for example, the expression per stirpes, which is the way in which an inheritance can occur. That is, it goes down through the stripes, through the son to the children to the children, and so on, per stirpes. It took 16 words in the Succession Act to explain.
That's engaging and fascinating.
But not to the point.
Let's move on. After you retired from, how long were you a judge for?
20-odd years.
20-odd years.
Yeah.
And you moved on. But tell us, there's other things I've got to get to, and that is your Royal Commission. You're appointed to two substantial Royal Commissions in our country's history. Just take us through that, Margaret.
The first one, I was asked before I retired, but as you know, we have statutory senility in Australia. So in Queensland, you have no doubt that you're going to retire when you're 70 because you have no option. So just before that happened, the attorney of the day in the Campbell Newman government asked me if I would do, there'd been a lot of talk in the press about it, a review into the racing industry and its governance. The new government thought that there'd been some dirty work at the crossroads about money for race course improvements in various marginal seats, and they were looking for that kind of an outcome, which they didn't get. So I said, I know nothing about racing at all. And so the attorney said, well, that's why I'm asking you, because everyone else tells me that they'd be very good for the job because they know a lot about racing, which I thought was pretty funny. That really set me thinking that it is not so much wickedness, but it's incompetence often in government and a failure of the independent regulators. Because had the regulator really not been captive to the racing industry, and I'm not insulting the people, they were not very senior public servants. It's very difficult for them because they're such overbearing personalities and important personalities who appeared to have the ear of government. I think a lot of those issues wouldn't have arisen. And Quentin, just reflect upon it. I'm pretty sure it's the same in the Banking Royal Commission. Had the regulators actually been doing their job meticulously, a lot of those things wouldn't have been necessary.
Well, I suppose from all our experience in Australia, I think there's public consciousness about the phenomenon known as regulatory capture, where the regulator is captured by the vested interests of the industries they're meant to be regulating.
That's right.
And hopefully many people working in regulation are very well aware of that, but it still requires constant vigilance and education to make people aware that when they're duchessed or potentially captured with the political influence as well.
That's true. And one's surely constantly shocked at the socialisation, the socialising that occurs between regulators and those they're regulating, going off on fishing trips.
And they can hire them. You know, you leave the regulator and you get a job, a well-paid job in the industry you were meant to be regulated.
But of course, the real and fundamental problem is the underfunding of those institutions. So
yeah, the resourcing of them. Yeah.
So the Auditor General, for example, I have the greatest admiration for that office, but diminished in its funding. So the number of really good reviews that they can do are lessened. The oversight of our public institutions by a highly accomplished regulator is key.
But Margaret, you and I will be denounced as supporters of red tape, or in the case of environmental conservation issues, green tape. It's a very powerful political meme, as they say, to stand down regulators or defund the regulators.
Well, of course, that gives open slather, doesn't it? All sorts of liquidations.
Look at Musk and Trump at the moment.
So they can make money.
Inevitably. Look, you did the Northern Territory. So I'm trying to get my notes here just to remind me. You did the child protection detention in the Northern Territory.
I did.
Just briefly about that. That was a confronting experience.
It was very confronting. I had the great good fortune to have as co-commissioner Mick Gooder, who's a great friend, I'm honoured to say. And we used to say we were joined at the hip because we had similar approaches to policy development and what ought to happen. And he'd had a huge experience in the development of public policy. He was so well connected in Australia. So it was a great honour to be with Mick. He used to take me into the chairman's lounge, Quinton, and people would come up to see him, from ambassadors to ministers. It was wonderful. Yes, it was confronting. Again, when Mr. Turnbull said, as we neared the end of our inquiry and we had that informal meeting, just so there won't be any surprises, he said, "I suppose you're going to ask for a lot of money." And Mick said to him, "Well, Prime Minister, we think there's enough money goes into the Northern Territory. It's just very poorly spent." He was a bit cross about that response. Mm. But the Commonwealth did take that attitude. I thought that was very, very obvious. Buckets of money, but they couldn't even tell us what programs they were funding, and they certainly didn't want accountability for their money. When you ask those wonderfully keen young people doing programs for all sorts of not-for-profits in the Northern Territory funded by the Commonwealth, what their exit strategy was, they looked very puzzled. They didn't think of themselves as capacity builders.
Yes.
It was still Uncle Tom's Cabot thinking.
I regret to say that's true. You're sort of retired or semi-retired. How would you describe your? I know you're intellectually inquisitive and you're still reading. Are you doing anything in apart from the Centre for Public Integrity, which is what I want to get to now? Anything else you're doing? Have you written papers and things to get things off your chest?
I tend not to do that now. I think I had the feeling that I'd probably, I had to give some speeches and things like that. And I was involved with the Churchill Trust for many, many years and sort of would do some speeches for them and so on. A wonderful institution, as you know. Last year, I decided at 81, 30th of June, that I would not renew my practicing certificate. That doesn't mean you can't do things, but it was a good way of saying, that's it, you know, really let others do it. And inevitably one's intellectual powers are dwindling and it's necessary to get ahead of the game on that, I think. So the last big thing I did was the Royal Commission in Papua New Guinea into the UBS loan affair. And that was pretty interesting. That told me that Australia had really dropped the ball on PNG. We should have been up there helping in a disinterested way with their institutions.
In a non-colonial way.
Well, we didn't have a good reputation. Of course, they looked elsewhere in 1974 when they were looking for independence. They looked to African countries. They even had a Canadian, but they didn't have any Australians helping them at all.
Still dropped the ball. It sounds like we've still dropped the ball on PNG.
Well, that's my feeling. It was very interesting to see, for example, it was during COVID, and so it wasn't easy to come and go. So I went up there for a block of time to see a lot of signs on all the stovey pipes in Mandarin, in Chinese. They're very comfortable about the Chinese being around. Where were we?
Mm.
Well, we sponsored a very nice little art festival.
Mm.
Yeah. And there were lovely people in the High Commission, but their brief was not encouraging.
Mm.
Not encouraging at all.
So you're now a director of the Centre for Public Integrity, and what motivated you to become involved with the centre after this experience? I mean, you've done your fair share.
Done lots of things, and I've been very privileged to have been offered them, and I tend not to say no. So that's good. Look, I think it was the realisation that democracy is not the default position. The democratic institutions that we take for granted is actually pretty unusual in the spectrum of history. We think that it will go on getting better, but as we can see, the trajectory actually is dropping back. So there was perhaps, you might call, a sort of gilded age after the Second World War when democratic institutions were emerging, respected, developed. It looks as though they may be slipping back a bit. And it's very important that everyone actually understands this, because democracy means sharing power, and lots of people do not wish to do this. So the natural state of man in society, I think, is actually to slip into autocracy of some form or another. It always has been. And so I'm still raging against the dying of the democratic light. It sounds so ridiculous, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't sound ridiculous. It's absolutely essential for all of us to understand that and to stand up for a functioning democracy, which includes accountability. Margaret, you've been wonderful. Thanks very much for sharing your life and story with the Centre for Public Integrity. All the best.
Thanks, Quentin. An honour to chat with you.